This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breininger, inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in South Asia, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am Sneha Anavarapu, the host of this channel, and I'm so thrilled to be in conversation with Professor Ginny Lokanitha, author of The Truth Machines, Policing, Violence, and Scientific Interrogations in India, which was published by University of Michigan Press earlier this year. Congratulations, Ginny, on this really rigorous and interesting book. It is so good to have a chance to chat with you about it.
Thanks so much, Sneha, for doing this interview and for engaging with the book.
Yeah, you're welcome. The pleasure is all mine. I thought we could start with you telling us a little bit about yourself, perhaps how you became a political scientist.
That's actually a really interesting and difficult question for me. So I grew up in India and went to Delhi University, did my bachelor's, master's and MPhil in political science at First Kirori Mal College and at Delhi University. And I really loved political science, partly because of the relationship that it had with sort of, diverse methodologies, as well as more substantive questions of political theory, but also sort of thinking about what was happening in terms of social movements and people's movements. So when I came to the US to do my PhD, I was told that political science is highly quantitative and asking me to sort of think about other disciplines like sociology and anthropology. Yet I stuck to political science and often then think about my ambivalent relationship with political science. What I mean by that is, my work doesn't necessarily fit in any one particular subfield, right? But maybe closest to political theory. And what attracts me to political science is the fact that we are asking these bigger questions about state, policing, justice, equality, me getting attracted to sort of looking at different methodologies, which are much more interpretive and qualitative. So I think political science has now become much more open in the US to different kinds of methodologies and questions. And that's the tradition I place myself in.
Mm-hmm. That's excellent. And, I also empathize with feeling a lack of orientation towards any particular subfield, because even in my own discipline, that's sociology, I'm often like, I don't know what subfield I belong to. So thank you for that. Clearly, I feel much better that I have a place in academia after listening to your story. That anyway, before we dive into the book's arguments, I am curious to know from you how this particular book was conceived or how this project sort of unfolded over the years.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, my general focus of my work has been on trying to understand the relationship between law and violence and state in liberal democracies. And so in my first book, Transnational Torture, I looked at sort of the jurisprudence of interrogations in both US and India as two examples of liberal democracies. And in that particular context, I found that even though torture was sort of assumed to be absent in a liberal democracy, yet these practices sort of always continued. And part of what I looked at was to show how law itself was able to accommodate excess violence, which is the concept that I talk about in my first book. And that sort of made me think much more about what is really the apparatus through which state manages its own violence. And it was sort of a chance comment by a friend who told me that a DGP that she was in touch with said that, oh, narco analysis and these methods only came into being because they were meant to replace physical torture. And this was something that I'd seen in the jurisprudence also, that, you know, torture can only be replaced by scientific methods of investigation. So I decided to focus on that, but in a different way, where interviews were the way through which I did this particular project, as opposed to looking at documents and popular representations and cases that I did in my first book. So in this one, I went to five cities, Bangalore, Ahmedabad, Mumbai, Delhi, and Hyderabad, and interviewed psychologists, forensic psychologists in particular, police, lawyers, and activists. And I think the reason why I thought it was really important to do this kind of work was to think about state and policing differently, rather than thinking about state as a very monolithic entity. If you think about the theories of state that are most known in the context of political science, but also more broadly, then either there's sort of this idea of, a Weberian conception of the state, which sort of talks about the monopoly over legitimate violence, or sort of this Agambanian, conception of the state, which is sort of talking about a state as a much more, exceptional, sovereign, that is able to control bare life. And I was very interested in sort of understanding violence as it was experienced by those who engage with the everyday state actors. And that really brought me to Truth Machines, the book that I recently wrote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so going off of that, in Truth Machines, you think through state power and legal violence in India by analyzing the rather fraught deployment of three techniques, that is lie detectors, brain scans, and narcoanalysis, and how they're used in investigations. Could you tell us a little bit about when these techniques began to get used in India and the general debates around their use that have arisen since?
Yeah, so what I do in Truth Machines is to talk about three forensic psychology-based techniques, which is, as you said, polygraphs or lie detectors, brain scans, and narcoanalysis. And let me just very briefly introduce those techniques and then, talk about how they originated and became important in the Indian context. So polygraphs are, of course, most well-known in terms of how bodily indicators are supposed to reflect whether you are, telling a lie or truth. And brain scans are much more in the context of trying to read, experiential activity in the brain. So the idea is that you have an electroencephalogram, which can actually determine whether you had experience of committing that crime. And that's something that is claimed when you're talking about methods like brain fingerprinting or brain electrical oscillation signature test, which is the Indian version of brain scanning. And finally, narcoanalysis, which is about the use of drugs, particularly sodium pentothal, which is used in order to, inject it into somebody so that they can be asked questions and ostensibly lead to the person telling the truth and not being able to tell a lie. So these are the three techniques that I term truth machines because of the claim made by forensic psychologists that these actually allow for the police and the forensic psychologists to get truth in the context of a crime. These techniques started getting used in India at different phases. So polygraphs we've seen were there from the 70s onwards. But really, what I trace in the book is that it's in the late 80s and 90s in particular that you see the emergence of these techniques all together in a big way. And I trace that also to the fact that basically post 90s is also the time that you see a consolidation of the human rights movements in India, right? Mm-hmm. So post-emergency, you see the emergence of human rights groups, the civil liberty and democratic rights groups, as well as the more quasi-state ones, right? The National Human Rights Commission. Mm-hmm. And they all start focusing on human rights violations, and particularly the question of custodial deaths and custodial torture. From the time that we have the data from the 1990s to now, basically there are high rates, high incidences of both custodial torture, but also custodial deaths, mm-hmm. where basically you see both deaths in police custody as well as judicial custody. So part of what I trace in the book is to recognize that these techniques become extremely important during the 1990s, but mid-2000s, suddenly any major case you see, right, whether it's the Arushi murder case, Arushi Hemraj murder case, or mm-hmm. poaching cases, or, the anti-terror cases, you find that, there's this articulation of the need to use a combination of these truth machines as if they are the ones that are going to really transform the Indian criminal justice system. And mm-hmm. that's the story that, I try to trace in the context of these particular techniques.
Yeah, thank you. That was really helpful, I think, especially for listeners who haven't had a chance to read the book yet. That was a really helpful context and argument. But in the book, you also argue theoretically that paying attention to the everyday functioning of the police and this reliance on non-state actors like forensic psychologists, you tell us that it tells us something important about the relationship of the police to violence. Thinking through these truth machines, you contend can provide insight into what you call the workings of a contingent state. So I was wondering if you could speak about why thinking about contingency matters to the study of state power in general, but post-colonial policing in particular. And I know you brought up Weber and Agamben, but if you could say a little more about how you were thinking about the state in that sense, it would be great.
So I think one of the major points that I'm trying to make in the book is about methodology. And here, of course, you know, I draw a lot from sort of what has been the work done in anthropology, in particular, sort of everyday, you know, everyday practices of the state telling us something about both bureaucratic practices, but also I wanted to think about it in the context of police and violence, right? Partly mm-hmm. because when we think about the police are really the everyday, you know, actors, everyday state actors who, you know, are responsible for managing the state interaction with the populations. So in that sense, I find it very, very intriguing that a number of scholars of the state, which of course is, you know, a very, very commonly talked about institution in the context of political science, but never really looked at the question of police, right? Mm-hmm. So police was always sort of thought of as something which is either inherently violent or mm-hmm. something which is, you know, seen as so bureaucratic that you basically do not necessarily need to look at the everyday practices. So I do think that that sort of brought me to the question of methodology about studying both the state and police as a site of state power. And here I just want to briefly refer to, you know, one of the interviews that for me was very, very interesting, which was with this particular police officer in Bangalore, who was telling me how, you know, he sort of moved into being much more of a critic of the police mm-hmm. as a student leader to becoming a police officer. And he tells the story of how he was involved in a murder case of a couple, and one of them, who the one person dies, and the other person is this woman who survives, and you know, is tells him about this particular auto driver who attacked her, and in that particular context, you know. He's told that he can't use third degree or physical torture. Third degree is often a term that the police would use to sort of not want to talk about torture, right? So they would say third degree. And in that particular context, I sort of thought that he's now going to tell me something about narcoanalysis, because this is the context in which I had sort of asked about his experience. But he went on and told me that, you know, I just went ahead and mixed, you know, two kinds of alcohol and just gave him, and he blurted out everything. And for me, it was a very striking moment because, you know, it told us something about how we think about police practices and what this particular police was, police action or police articulation was telling us. And what I mean by that is when you look at the scholars, particularly those who have looked at mechanisms of torture and, you know, state executions more closely. And here, I think a lot of this work has been done in the context of, let's say, the US, where a number of scholars like Austin Sarek and others have pointed to the way in which the mechanisms of execution change, right? And they change in such a way that they become more humane over time. So, you know, you think about hanging or electric chair to lethal injection. So they appear humane. For now, I'm not talking about whether they still are painful or not, right? But they appear more humane than the previous ones. Similarly, you know, when you think about, you know, Darius Rejali and others sort of talking about scarring and non-scarring forms of torture, there is sort of this idea that state is much more intentional about the way in which we think about the changes in the methods of violence, right? And what was interesting in the narrative that I just talked about, this police officer, is that it is actually much more arbitrary. It is much more sort of contingent in the way that, you know, the police sort of come up with their own methods of how to, you know, extract information. You know, I'll just mention one other element in this particular context where basically the police, another police officer, when I asked him about narco, said, "Do you mean unofficial narco or official narco?" And basically, you find that they have methods of either using a local doctor coming in, you know, giving some kind of medicines, or basically a range of different things, which you know, which is from alcohol to marijuana to sometimes using, you know, favorite rice dishes like biryani. And all these become sort of a part of this narrative, which at one time tells us that it's not in, there's no intentional state strategy always that we can think about, but also that there's sort of this arbitrariness to the kinds of methods that the police end up using, which cannot be captured by our categories without looking at the everyday practices. So I think that for me is really important for us to understand why the everyday practices of the police and state need to be both studied, but are also not captured in the sort of monolithic conceptualizations that sometimes scholars use of the state and police.
Mm-hmm. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccoli, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, thank you for that. I also, you know, found it very compelling when you argued that the truth machines fit India's developmentalist approach to modernization based on scientific expertise. And I found even more interesting how you then linked this discussion between a developmentalist approach and truth machines to the twinned characterization of the Indian police as both pastoral and repressive at once. Could you perhaps tease out this link and speak a little bit about how the pastoral and repressive functions of policing coexist?
Thanks. I think what I found very interesting is that, you know, when I first started this particular project on state and policing, right, and trying to think about the link between law, science, and policing, you know, to understand the relationship between state power and legal violence, I found that a lot of the times people sort of thought of, why look at such marginal methods that are happening in a few forensic science labs? And for me, it was very important to tease out how basically these forensic techniques actually tell you a much larger story about what you just mentioned, which is sort of this developmentalist approach to modernization based on scientific expertise, right? And you see that in a range of different kinds of studies, right? So Timothy Mitchell sort of talks about it in the context of Egypt, or Shirupa Roy talks about, you know, how science and development become so important in sort of the Nehruvian model. But what is fascinating for me is that, you know, a similar kind of an attention was not paid to the way in which police tried to think about its modernization, you know, regime, right? And so part of what I end up doing is to sort of think about the emergence of these forensic techniques in discussions of modernization of the police as technical solutions to policing and violence, right? So basically, there's a recognition that police have to play a different role in a post-colonial society. And the way that that leads to the emergence of these particular forensic techniques is a fascinating story for me. What that does is to sort of move away from another kind of an understanding of the police, which was much more sort of ideological, right? And what I mean there is, you know, either an understanding that police is just sort of an instrument of, you know, the dominant sections of society, right? Coming much more from a kind of a Marxist perspective, but also, you know, thinking about it, the police playing an ideological role differently in terms of trying to promote a concept of justice or public order, and which a number of recent scholars have sort of pointed to. But, you know, and in addition, there's also this argument about police just following a colonial continuity, right? So part of what I wanted to do by, you know, focusing on the internal logic of the police was to think about the tensions that you see the police themselves acknowledge, right? And, you know, I do that in two ways in the book. One is sort of looking at the reform kind of committees, right, from the Gore Committee to a National Police Commission to Malimat, and also recognize that, you know, at each moment, the police are sort of thinking about their own relationship to violence, right, internally. And also that, you know, what was fascinating for me was that the police gave their own pragmatic reasons for why torture was being used. So, you know, for instance, they talk about the distrust, right, that they experience because they cannot actually record confessions unlike other police in other jurisdictions, right, or other countries. Or the fact that, you know, there are incentives within the law through exceptions in the law that basically ask them to actually show evidence or materials that have been that have been discovered through the use of torture or confessions. So you cannot use the confessions under the law, right? But you can actually use some of the materials or recovered evidence, you know, as an exception within the law. Right, so these are all sort of what I call the pragmatic logic of third degree torture, which is not to say that, you know, that we basically recognize the need to change all of these. But at the same time, I think it's important for us to both recognize these structural or institutional constraints and contingencies in the way the police themselves articulate the need for using third-degree torture. And finally, and this is something that you referred to, which is the relationship between sort of how do we think about this kind of an external understanding of the police, which is much more ideological, and a kind of an internal logic of the kind of conversations that are happening within the police, for me, led me to sort of think about the pastoral and the repressive. conceptions of the police. And here, of course, you know, I'm referring to Foucauldian concepts and those used by new police science scholars such as Mark Dubber and others, who are sort of asking us to look at the tensions within the role of the police itself. And the way in which I sort of think about it, in the particular context of police relationship to violence, is to think about how, even in the context of custody, right, where basically we know very little often about what goes on in custody, the police actually, feel the pressure of mediating their forms of violence. And that is sort of why I say that the pastoral doesn't replace the repressive, but it mediates the repressive. In other words, they are much more fearful of a custodial death or a custodial injury. As we know, that those are the kinds of cases, right, when there are sort of bloody injuries or deaths in custody, that it becomes apparent in the public context. So in that context, I'm suggesting that we have to look at the pastoral and the repressive. Whether we can think about that more generally about the police as an institution is something that requires much more work. I would say that I sort of am thinking about, a very specific site, right, which is about the police relationship to violence, where they are assumed to have a sort of a monopoly over violence. But even there, partly due to the impact of the kind of pressures that we see from the human rights movements and the critiques from them has led to this kind of a pastoral and the repressive coexisting.
Yeah, I mean, I really appreciated that kind of fine-grained acknowledgement of how the police also think of themselves and how that in a way gives rise to these mediations between the pastoral and repressive. It certainly resonated with me as someone who also does ethnographic work amongst law enforcement officers. So I really appreciated that. But in chapter 3, you sort of go on a slightly different tack, I mean, a related tack, of course, and you delve into the debates and discussions around the validity of truth-telling techniques. And you argue that the legitimacy of these techniques is a cultural question more than a scientific or legal one. I invite you to perhaps take one of the techniques as an example and tell us a little bit about how this cultural validation works.
Sure. So, as I said, I talk about the three techniques. In each of these, what is very important to recognize is that, the history, whether it's in the US or in India, and I talk about the sort of comparative stories of origins and sustenance of these truth machines in US and India, one finds that there is no scientific reliability or validity, right? You find that every time there is excitement about these techniques as it sort of, proceeds and becomes popular, what sustains it is not that the scientific community thinks that this is one of the best ways of getting information or truth, but rather the fact that there is a popular kind of a conception that sustains it. I will just mention here, for instance, Jeffrey Bunn, who talks about spectacular science, right, talks about how the lie detectors in the US were only sustained because of Pulp Fiction. Right, or Wonder Woman and the lasso, right, are examples in popular culture that sustain it. And yet the impact of it is such that despite legal, rejection or scientific rejection, you find that polygraph still becomes, one of the key moments in the Kavanaugh hearings, just to give you, that example. because there is a popular conception that somewhere polygraphs are more have more acceptance, right? And the main reason I trace this history is what happens often is that, because we think about forensic techniques or, any policing practices are dependent on often the legal interventions, right? That once courts say that, oh, these are not admissible, right? The results of these are not admissible, which is sort of the even in the Indian context, they're not admissible. The debate sort of stops there, right? And what I find limiting in this kind of a perspective is that it does not acknowledge the role that these scientific techniques or these forensic techniques play in a popular or cultural production of truth. And here's a quick example. I talk in the book about the Arushi case, which was, of course, about a young girl who was found murdered, and then domestic help Hemraj, he was found murdered as well. And basically, the parents were convicted for those two murders. And basically, there were a number of issues with this very complicated legal case, and tells us a lot about, how criminal investigations are done. But the part that was fascinating for me and sort of makes this point about cultural production is that there was a very visible campaign to challenge the conviction of the parents. And there were two movies made, Talwar and Rahasya, a book written by Avirukh Sen, and basically a podcast, Trial by Error. And for me, each of them were very interesting about how they pushed the results of narco analysis of the Hemraj's friends, right? Some aides who were also seen in the context of that case. And once the acquittal of the parents happened, the forensic psychologist gave statements saying that, look, we always told you that narco analysis was important in the case, even though legally it was not admissible. So this is a really good example for us to think about how the life of these techniques stay beyond the law. And that's one of the reasons that in the Hathras case, where a Dalit woman was recently gang raped and murdered, right? You find that the state government proclaimed that narco analysis will be done. That is a constant reminder of what is the cultural role of these techniques as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for that. It really gives one a lot to think about, especially in light of the Hathras case, as you mentioned. So in chapter 4, you explore what you call the state forensic architecture and the fashioning of forensic psychologists as experts. You then show the kinds of frictions that arise in terms of forensic psychologists working with the Indian police, who they are technically under police charge. Specifically, you reveal that while forensic psychologists try to distance their own work from police work, the net results seem to reinforce the structure of Indian policing in its violent and confessional mode. I was hoping you could share with our listeners a glimpse of how this mechanism of reproduction of policing structure really works.
As I'd mentioned, I talk about the emergence of these techniques around first in the 70s, but really in the 90s. What you actually end up seeing is that even though there were particular, very, very arbitrary, contingent reasons why these practices came into being, right? There were ambitious forensic psychologists who thought these might work, others who wanted to sort of gain popularity and ended up making claims that they are infallible, and narco videos were leaked to the media. there was a particular moment in the early 2000s that you actually see the Ministry of Human Resources, right, or Home Affairs, Ministry of Home Affairs, in the context of India, sort of proclaim that these techniques or expansion of these forensic techniques as the priority of policing, right, using science. And that's something I term as sort of the state forensic architecture. And one of the reasons why, you know, that's so important is that it gave a lot of importance to the role of forensic psychologists. And the way that the forensic psychologists that I interviewed talked about, basically, they wanted to constantly distance themselves from the police, right? Spatially, professionally, and therapeutically. So they really believed that they were able to use empathy, patience, you know, not sort of create trauma for these people who are accused of crimes and help them come to terms with it, right? And because the use of these techniques, ostensibly according to the forensic psychologists, could only work if a person was not physically or mentally traumatized, then basically they could claim that by definition, they were trying to replace physical torture. So in some ways, what I found fascinating was that these forensic psychologists who are in a forensic science lab, which otherwise deals with different kinds of samples, right, as a serologist or something else or a DNA expert, but they said they were the only ones who sort of had live suspects, right? So they constantly sort of played this role where they almost showed themselves as what I called a cyborg, right? Sort of this human and machine morphing from one to the other, at times talking about science and at other times talking about art, but the art coming from their psychological training, psychology-based training. So I did think that it was an attempt to recognize some kind of a gesturing of a non-state actor or a semi-state actor, as I call them, basically who are different from the police. But the issue, of course, is that what they ended up doing was recreating another site for confessions, right? So basically, what they would do is, and they say that in their interviews, in the articles, that basically it's meant to force them to confess, to get information. In fact, one of the labs I went to, the director said to me, those who we cannot physically torture, we just bring them to the labs to basically get these confessions or information. So I do think that given the kind of emphasis on forcing somebody to betray their, betray oneself and use of science and experts, basically strengthened both the cultural production argument that I talked about earlier, a modernizing developmentalist mode of expert and science, but also, fail to actually, create another site which was free of coercion or violence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that point came through really beautifully, if I may say so, in the chapter. And I thank you for summarizing that so well for the podcast. Yes. I was very intrigued by chapter 5, where you suggest that the inclusion of scientific investigative techniques represent what you call the liberal state's desire to modernize, along with a reluctance to challenge the conditions for the persistence of torture. And you term this dynamic peculiarly postcolonial. Could you tell us a little bit about why this dynamic is peculiarly post-colonial?
So what I found in terms of the role of the courts was that, you know, you basically have the high courts, which were asked to come in to mediate what the state officials and the police were saying on one hand, right, that basically these are, you know, just new forms of torture. And what, sorry, I should rephrase that. They were replacing physical torture is what the police and the state officials were saying. And the critics, who were primarily at that time civil liberty scholars and activists, they sort of pointed to the fact that these are just new forms of physical or psychological torture, right? And so the state high courts, and there were a number of cases that came up challenging the use of these forensic techniques. And for me, what was very interesting is the fact that the state high courts basically, for the most part, embraced these techniques wholeheartedly, right? They said these are just extensions of investigation. They said they are safe because you have medical experts there who will ensure basically, you know, that physical third degree is here replaced by reliable, you know, methods. And even when the Supreme Court came in to intervene in this particular case, it ended up focusing on the involuntariness of these techniques, saying that you cannot use them or force people to be subjected to these techniques. And yet did not sort of recognize that basically the techniques themselves were coercive and therefore should not be used because they take away any idea of voluntariness, right? By the very use of these techniques. When you inject drug into somebody, you know, there's very little scope for voluntariness. And they did not also challenge the role of the doctors or the medical professionals or forensic psychologists in this particular role and failed to recognize that they were actually not making the connection between what was happening in the context of these truth machines to conditions of torture, right? Which they had previously talked about, right? So you have a huge jurisprudence which actually recognizes that the you know Indian state has constantly failed to check police torture. And yet the very conditions that allow for you know these practices to continue, right, are not challenged by the Supreme Court by thinking of this these particular truth machines in a very narrow way of inadmissibility and involuntariness. Now, why do I call it a peculiarly post-colonial context? Is because I think time and time again, right, you see a very stark kind of tension between what happens in the legal rhetoric and what actually is allowed to exist in terms of both reality, but the legal provisions that, you know, that create conditions for torture, right? So to give you, you know, just another example is, you know, when you have extraordinary laws like, you know, the anti-terror laws earlier or Armed Forces Special Powers Act or UAPA, which take away basic safeguards in custody, then you're actually not, you know, you are simultaneously having a rhetoric against torture, but not challenging the conditions that are producing torture. And I think this sort of allows for the coexistence of all forms of violence, right? Physical, mental, and excess violence. And that sort of makes it a peculiarly post-colonial because it allows for coexistence of several regimes of violence to continue, and there's a constant sort of legal attempt to keep them separate, as if they don't all tell us the different ways through which law accommodates violence.
Right. I mean, that's honestly terrifying to think through. Well, so chapter six, in a sense, presents the coda to the arguments that you have been making thus far, drawing on the experiences of terror suspects in two cases, that of the Mumbai blasts and the Makkah Masjid case in Hyderabad. You theorize, and very persuasively, if I may add, that the rule of law is a scaffold that relies on procedures to mask the violence of the state. I would love it if you could flesh this out for our listeners using one of the two cases as a concrete example.
Sure. So I think, you know, in that particular chapter, I'm very much interested in to rethink the way in which we theorize the concept of the rule of law, right? So this idea that, you know, there's a constraint on sort of liberal states in particular, right, and on coercive authority, and some kind of critique of a dominant conception of rule of law is, of course, sort of thinking about, you know, ideas of rule by law or violence of jurisprudence and so on. But part of what I'm interested in is to again think about, you know, is there a kind of a scaffold of a rule of law to see whether procedures themselves actually hide violence, right? And here, you know, the idea of the scaffold is, of course, coming from a Foucauldian concept where he talked about the spectacle of the scaffold, right? And there the idea was to show sovereign power. And here the scaffold of the rule of law is doing something exactly the opposite, right? Which is that the violence that is allowed is actually hidden in the procedures. And what I mean by that is, you know, when you look at the Makkah Masjid case, which was, of course, a case in 2007, where there was a blast in the courtyard and about nine people were killed, basically, you know, several Muslim youth were picked up and they were detained illegally and tortured, right? Now, the rule of law required them, and I think maintaining the rule of law scaffold required them to be produced in front of magistrates. But the way they were done was to basically bring them in the middle of the night, and the magistrate basically sending them to, you know, remand without sort of checking on their conditions, right? So here's a great example of how the safeguards in law are being technically followed, right? Medical exams or even bringing in front of the magistrates, but the role that they are supposed to play are completely, sort of undermined, right? And this happens in particular with the, you know, terrorism-related cases, right? But it can also happen in just routine cases, because as we know, custodial torture and deaths in India also happen in many routine cases. And a similar hiding of the violence within the procedures are sort of seen in that context. But there is sort of another reason why I think it's really important for us to look at the scaffold of the rule of law, is to see that, you know, revealing these practices actually also show the way in which resistance and cracks and shifts can be articulated. And this is something that I try to do in throughout the book, is to think about, you know, what is it that revealing the inner workings of the policing or this kind of a scaffold does for those who experience the violence directly, right? And I find that basically, particularly in the Makkah Masjid case, because the community got involved, there were challenges made to the ways in which FIRs were identical for everybody. The narco tests were being delegitimized and so on and so forth, allowed for sort of the challenging of the scaffold as well. And that is, another part of the story. So that Makkah Masjid case, everybody was acquitted. There were talk about, compensation for torture, which is extremely rare. There was a possibility of recognizing the way in which, the policing apparatus works and can be challenged from within.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks for, so beautifully articulating responses to all of my questions about the book. And I personally found it very interesting to read. I would just like to congratulate you again on writing this really interesting and very relevant book for the kinds of discussions going around regarding police violence and the law in India. But before we let you go, I'm sure we would all love to know, what are you working on currently and what might we expect to see from you in the near future?
As you pointed out, I think what has been striking for me is, how it's resonating with some of the current discussions globally about police and violence, right? So, I do feel that the kind of resonance globally of the murder of George Floyd in the context of the US and the kind of upsurge we saw was also seen in the context of a custodial death case in India, for instance, in Tamil Nadu in June. And I think that just has me thinking a lot about, can we think about the impact of policing becoming a moment of reckoning for democracy that we saw in the US? Can we see a similar move in the context of India as well? And I do see that whenever I'm presenting, I'm asked about these questions about abolition of the police and so on and so forth, which I think is a very, very important moment. And I'm currently trying to think about, the resonance of these ideas in the US, in the context of India as well. The other project that I've been working on for a while is sort of thinking about state commissions of inquiry. We look at legal cases, and that's one major way through which we think about state violence. But I'm also interested in, what is the role that commissions of inquiry play in helping us understand, state processes of dealing with violence? And, I worked a little bit in the context of the Manorama case in Manipur, but I'm really interested in taking this up more theoretically. So these are two preoccupations at the moment as we move forward.
Yeah, well, thank you for sharing that with us. And I'm sure your hands are full with lots of the new book related events. So all the best with that. And yeah, thanks again for taking time out to chat with me today. I really appreciate it. And take care and stay safe.
Thank you so much.